Year 2000. Now, here is Chet Huntley.
We'll be celebrating a special New Year's Eve. Bells will ring, orchestras will play Auld Lang Syne, boys and girls will embrace, and a new century will be upon us. It will be the year 2000, or, if you prefer, 2000. What shall we call it? 2000, perhaps. A baby born tonight could not be president of the United States in the year 2000. He would not yet have attained the constitutional age of 35 years. Statistics indicate that about three-fourths of the people listening to me at this moment will live to see that year, which is no further in the future than the election of Franklin Roosevelt is in the past. What do we know about year 2000? Well, ecologists tell us that in that year, we will have run very nearly out of food, that half the world's population will be on a starvation diet. We can project the so-called electronic revolution and predict that the number of workers engaged in actual production will drop to only 18% of the workforce. At the same time, the number of people in all the various service occupations will almost double. Experts tell us we will cluster more than ever into cities, drive electrically powered cars, work less, and retire earlier. But what about these things? What will they mean to you and me, to the average worker and to his family? Those cities, for example, what are they going to be like? We talked with Philip Johnson, the distinguished architect now engaged in designing the John F. Kennedy Memorial for Dallas. And we asked him, Mr. Johnson, will we have rescued our cities by the year 2000, or will they be complete jungles?
They'll be complete jungles. It's very simple. There won't be any chance of fixing them up by the year 2000. Our whole setup is against fixing up cities. We pay, as you know, in New York, for example, vast sums to the federal government and get, I think, 1 or 2% back for use for our city, and that cannot go on. Obviously, everybody knows this. Nobody's doing anything about it, and in the next 10 or 30 years, nothing will be done. Simple prognostication.
They'll be wastelands, then?
Just as the way they are now, yes, sir. Just a little worse. Not much worse.
I assume, then, there'll still be Negro ghettos and Puerto Rican ghettos and Mexican...
I think the luck there's on the other side. I don't think we can stand that anymore. I don't think from a human point of view. You can stand the Brooklyn areas and Harlem areas the way they are now. I don't think any man in his senses would let this last that long. No, that will be fixed. First.
Well, then, if that's fixed, won't there be a chance?
Exactly. There might be a chance. One likes to leave an open hope per year. Instead of 2,000, let's make it 2,500. But we will fix up the human thing first, even at the expense of some of these other terrible things. But they'll just get terribler, like air pollution, like water pollution. We, the biggest water city in the world, we can't see the water. All that kind of thing. Just get worse.
Will there be more individual homes, or will we all be living in condominiums and complexes of sorts?
All be living in complexes. We can't afford the individual home much more. We can't afford to take the land. We can't afford the utilities to get to them. It's a vain delusion that we're living in. Every man has his little castle with a little lawn around it. More and more, you notice an interesting statistic that the number of walls being sold is now multiplied by 10 over 5 years ago. We can't stand our neighbors anymore in the pseudo-country way. Well, the pseudo-country will give in to common sense. Eventually, we'll all live like rats in these 40-story condominiums.
What about innovations for the American home? How will we be keeping ourselves warm or cool?
I don't believe in innovation. I think we'll probably go slightly backward in that regard. We've had too much, so we can't keep the air conditioning systems running that we put in.
What about green grass and trees and fresh water and clean air?
Green grass and clear water and beautiful air. It's a nice dream. Are we going to have it or not, I think, depends on what the people of America want. And obviously, two things we want desperately to do. One is to go to the moon, and the other is to fight wars. And we do them well, and we spend... Oh, another thing we like to do is to build roads. Just the one program alone is $20 billion a year, you see. So $20 billion on that, $60 billion on the war, $20 or $30 billion a year on going to the moon. We do whatever we like in this country. We're the most powerful people in the world. We can clean up our air. There's no trick to it. Everybody knows how to do it. The price tag, $2 billion out of the $20, $40, $60 billion that we've been discussing. I sound like a preacher. I'm sorry, I'm not. I love to make money, and I'm busy at it. But I'm caught up in the same thing. But why can't we do that and build great buildings? Remember what Pericles said in the funeral oration. We can beat the Spartans. Actually, they didn't, but he thought they could at the time. We can beat the Spartans and still build the Parthenon. And they did. For 30 years, every citizen in Athens worked on that one building. Can you see you and me out there with a cold chisel working on the stones? No.
Mr. Johnson,
it makes one think.
I thank you, but you deflate me.
I'm kind of mad myself.
Not everyone is that pessimistic. Take our new Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Robert C. Weaver. Herbert Kaplow asked him what the city will be like in the year 2000.
Well, the first thing, I'm very happy that you put that question that way, because, you know, some people think by the year 2000 we won't have any cities. Of course we're going to have cities. We're going to have, I think, much better cities than we have now. I think they'll be more attractive. I think they'll be more viable. And I think they will have come to grips with some of the real problems that we have, problems of transportation, problems of air pollution, water pollution. And I think we will have made some real headway in solving some of the basic human problems of our cities. We probably will not get rid of all of our slums then or any other time, but we will have greatly reduced the incidence of slums and of blighted areas. And I think we will also have made great progress in wiping out poverty in this most affluent nation, as I think it will still be.
What will a city look like? We're getting just a few hints of it in some of our cities today.
This is very difficult to say. I don't think it's going to be the Buck Rogers type of thing where you're going to have people either living underground or, as one architect recently proposed to me, that they all live in one building that would be one continuous structure. I think you're going to have certain technological breakthroughs, but you know, people, and particularly American people, are pretty conventional about how they want to live. And they take to radical new ideas rather slowly. Now, this is not to say that there will not be great changes in the design. I think that, for example, we wouldn't recognize the way we move traffic by the year 2000. I think we would not probably recognize the type of rapid transit conveyance that we have. We probably will have a new type of control of automobiles coming in and going out of our cities. I think structurally we will have better laid out and better designed land use. But I think that we will basically recognize the shape of the city and the general outline of the city, which will be somewhat in similar to what we now know, with many advances in particular areas rather than a comprehensive overall change that will be completely revolutionary.
What about health? We talked with Dr. George Reeder, professor of medicine at Cornell and an author of the Medicare legislation. We asked him first about children, what sort of diseases they're likely to have.
Well, I will very likely still have the common cold, although it's possible that something will be found for that by that time. I think in general one can say that virus diseases in children may well be pretty well licked by vaccines, so that chickenpox and measles and other things of that sort, there will be effective vaccines to protect the population.
What about cancer? Will it be around?
Fairly certain that cancer will be around, although I think by then we may well have means of managing it better, so that there will undoubtedly be drugs that will arrest it or delay its development.
Will the transplanting of organs be a common practice?
Oh, I think very common indeed, and I think much more successful than it is today.
How long will the individual live? What will be the life expectancy?
Well, the demographers have calculated this, and of course it's open to hazards that we don't necessarily know, but their calculations show that women will probably live to have a life expectancy of 75 years and men of 69.6 years. There will be a growing disparity between men and women, and whether this can be corrected in the sense of giving men longer life is still open to question.
Is there a possibility that we'll have brand new diseases which up to now we haven't heard about?
I think there's a possibility there will be more genetic diseases. As the population increases, there's more opportunity for genetic abnormalities to occur. There's also, of course, the outside chance that some organism might be imported from outer space that we don't know about now and which we'd have no defense against.
Will we have enough doctors in the year 2000?
It doesn't look like we'll have enough doctors in the usually accepted sense of the term. That is, if we take the population ratios that organized medicine usually uses, we won't have enough doctors for the population. And some of the specialty groups have made calculations to show, for example, that perhaps less than half of the babies delivered will be delivered by obstetricians, unless there is some great increase in training of obstetricians. But I think what will happen instead is that doctors will combine into groups and work in institutions more and be assisted by technicians who will be supervised by the physician. The physician's role will be a different one. He'll be less of a personal physician. He'll be more of a man who makes decisions and manages than he is today.
In the year 2000, will medicine be cheaper than it is today, less costly, or more?
There's every expectation it will be more costly, because as each technological advance comes along, it has increased the cost of care.
Will state-paid-for medicine and private medicine be living happily side by side?
Government medicine will increase greatly. The government now pays for about a third of the medical care in the United States and may well come to pay half or even more. But there will still be privately supported care through insurance, I'm sure. And I think that this does not imply, this growth of government support does not imply a socialization so much as it does a matter of better allocation of tax dollars for the kind of things that people want.
How will we get around in that not so far off year 2000? William Ronan has some thoughts on that. He is chairman of New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and his plans presumably must stand up under the test of these coming 33 years. The first question for him is the obvious one. Dr. Ronan, will we continue to drown ourselves in automobiles and their exhaust fumes?
Well, Chad, I don't think that we're going to be able to continue to drown ourselves in automobiles with their exhaust fumes, because, first of all, the air pollution problem is one which has got to be reckoned with. It's a fact that you don't reduce air pollution. You can't get the pollutants out of the air very much. Therefore, we've got to stop polluting the air. So we've got to find some answer to the pollution problem from the point of view of the automobile. Number two, we've got to come up with a better method of moving people, particularly from the central city areas of our big cities to the suburbs, because the automobile just can't move the people in the great numbers that we move them today even, but tomorrow with a great increase in population that's projected for all of our metropolitan centers, we just simply will not be able to move the people back and forth during the working hours.
Well, by the process of simple elimination or deduction, then, that means some sort of mass transportation, doesn't it?
That's for sure.
What sort of mass transportation vehicles do you visualize?
I would say that, first of all, Chet, we're going to have the use of the railroads more intensively. Now, they'll be more modern, more efficient. Great speed will be produced on them, great acceleration. We have not found, as of the moment, any better way to move great masses of people than on the two rails with a steel wheel on those rails. And the Japanese experiments and some of our own indicate we will be able to move people very rapidly. I think you're going to have different kinds of motive power brought into play. The gas turbine engine is already being adapted for rail use. And I think we're going to have great improvements in the whole field of electrical energy there. It's not going to stop here, though. I think we're going to find new types of transportation. I think the vertical rise aircraft is just about to come into its own. So that we will be able to have airports which will be close in to the central parts of our cities, and these vertical rise aircraft will take very little space. They'll be able to take off and carry people. And I think they're going to prove be the answer to what some thought the helicopter would be able to produce for us in the past.
We've been inclined, when we talk about mass transportation, to talk about people. I dare say we move much more goods than we do people, do we not? What about the transportation of goods?
We've discovered that the container is a way in which we can move things more effectively than we could move things in bulk in the past. So that we have now containerization, where Materials are put into a container at the factory, even. They're put on a truck, taken to a rail siding. A rail flat car carries the container. It then goes alongside a ship, lifts onto a ship, and actually goes off overseas in a container.
Well, what about containerization as a solution to the traffic problem in New York? What if that container full of merchandise is coming to a retailer in the city? Any easement here that you see in the future?
I would anticipate that around our airports in the future, we're going to have more in the way of staging areas for, shall we say, breaking up containers, just as we have staging areas now around freight boat facilities and shipping centers developing in the newer port areas.
Well, what about the containerization of people, Dr. Ronan?
It might be a very efficient method. We haven't worked it out by any means, and it is looking into the future, whereby a person might get into a vehicle here in central Manhattan, for example, and this vehicle could be loaded with people from central Manhattan, could be taken out to an airport either by rubber or by rail, and become part of a giant aircraft which would carry the whole group to Fort Worth, Texas, where they could get out again and be taken into the center of town. This is by no means impossible.
Now, how about the technology that put John Citizen in this position? Will it really be so different? I.A. Lewis, called Bud, thinks so. He's the computer expert in the NBC News Elections Unit, and his thinking ranges far into the future. He attributes almost magical powers to the computer, while at the same time describing it as an idiot machine. We put the question, if what you say about the machines be true, we're going to be left with a lot of leisure on our hands, right?
I believe so. I really do. It seems to me that the progress of our economy over the last 50 years or so has been tending in this direction, and the computer has only tended to throw it over the cliff. It seems to me that the computer will replace a large number of skilled workmen so that you will have, as we do now, factories which once employed hundreds or even thousands of people, supervised by two or three or four or 20 or 30 people, all of whom do nothing but supervise computers.
Well, what will the others be doing?
My opinion is that we are going to have to readjust our old Puritan, perhaps, concepts of what a person should do with his life. We used to believe that work was ennobling, that a man who devoted himself to hard work was in some way virtuous. Now it seems to me that what is required is a different attitude toward what a man should do with his life, because there's not going to be all the jobs that used to be around.
Well, are you saying that we may have to develop a society in which we might conclude that non-work is ennobling?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, here, my feeling is, and of course I can't be sure, that there are the germs of this solution here now. You'll notice that the one idea which engages the youth of America now is something like a Peace Corps. There is a kind of a feeling that a person should dedicate his life to other people, not towards manufacture of material things, but toward the spiritual concepts. In other words, you may almost find a society which has a different a quasi-religious attitude, which is not on faith, but on good works. I think there are perhaps some great benefits to derive from all of this. Let's be utterly frank about it. Who in the world really likes to work? Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could convince yourself that it wasn't the right thing to work?
Well, Cotton Mather told me it was wonderful to work, and I'm still am inclined to believe him.
Well, I think most Americans would agree with you. I do believe, however, that the pursuit of pure science, the pursuit of good works in for my fellow man, could be a very satisfying way of devoting a life.
Well, all right. But who's going to hew the wood and draw the water now?
Well, I've already suggested that the computer is going to play a large part in this. You see, my feeling is that we are in the midst of a second industrial revolution, or an electronic revolution. It is the information, that ingredient, is what the computer will add to the manufacturing process and replace the worker who has been more and more shoved into the skilled category to provide that, because actual labor is very little required anymore.
The skilled labor will be fixing the machines, in other words.
Right.
Well, then, will there be a need for anyone to make decisions, to guide the machines, tell them what to do?
Very definitely. There will come out of this an electronic elite, if you like. There will be the society of the computer programmer, the man who will tell the machine how to perform its task. The thing about a computer is that it is the first, I think, universal machine. It is the machine which can perform any task. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even know what it's supposed to do until you tell it what to do. Well, what the telling of a machine of what it's to do, that is the program. And it is the programmer who really controls the means of production. It seems to me that if we must have, as I suggested before, an ethos in which work is not important, then we must also have a kind of a noblesse oblige in which certain electronic elite people realize it as their duty to help to supervise the economy.
Well, Bud, it seems to me you're still crediting these machines with unusual powers. These machines cannot produce new information. They can only distribute faster old information, right?
Well, I think you're right, but I'm not entirely sure. In other words, they certainly do process information at an incredible rate. And as a matter of fact, the computer is frequently referred to as an idiot machine, the kind of machine which can perform only 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 different functions, but it does it like a bandit. On the other hand, there seems to be a suggestion that, depending on how you define it, that a computer can learn. That perhaps, depending on what you mean by it, a computer can think. And it already seems possible, as a matter of fact, it's been demonstrated theoretically, that computers can reproduce themselves.
The mating song of the computer, actually sung by one of the so-called idiot machines.
Year 2000.
Thus far, we have examined man in the year 2000, his cities, his health, and how he will get around. And we have uncovered the possibility of a whole new ethic, a new way of computerized life in which work is not only rare, but not even virtuous. Well, that may or may not come about. Most experts think it won't. One of them is Arthur M. Ross, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Herbert Kaplow asked him what the workforce will look like.
The estimate is that in the year 2000, we'll have 122 million people actually employed, as compared with an average of 72 million last year in 1965. Now, that will be a 69% increase over last year, whereas the population will increase only about 59%. The difference is that a considerably larger proportion of the adult women will be working.
What kind of a work day will it be in 2000?
Well, certainly we will have a smaller work year in number of hours worked. It's hard to say what the work day will be because there are various alternatives in reducing hours.
We spoke with August Heckscher, head of the 20th Century Fund, about that. The problem, if we work only 3 days, of how to keep from going crazy with all that spare time.
My own feeling is that what one does in one's spare time is to do another kind of work. It may be a kind of work which is not paid, or at which one is paid at a lower rate, and it may be the kind of work one does out of love. But nevertheless, it has to be a serious work.
Well, aren't you, Mr. Heckscher, referring to an intellectual elite? What about all those people who just want to lie on the beach? Will they be able to just loaf?
Well, I'd say two things. One, I'm not really referring to an intellectual elite, because today one out of seven workers in this country, perhaps even a little more now, has a second job, moonlights, as we say. And often that second job is something which is enjoyable as well as profitable. As for what might be called pure recreation or pure filling up of spare time, there'll be lots of that, and there should be lots of that. But if spare time stretches too long, it ceases to be agreeable and becomes something like unemployment or idleness or an experience of frustration rather than a fulfillment.
If we have all this leisure, for loafing or not, we'll be at the mercy of the weather. Or will it be the other way around? Peter Hackett talked with a man who should know, Dr. Helmut Landsberg, Director of Environmental Data Service in the new Weather Bureau, now already equipped with a brand new 21st century name, Environmental Science Services Administration. The question is, how much weather modification will be possible by the year 2000?
My estimate is that we will probably start to work seriously to modify thunder clouds to reduce lightning. I think that we will possibly be able to have some sort of estimate of whether we can control tornadoes and such local severe storms. I think that we will not try to modify weather on a very large scale yet by that time, simply because the ramifications may be of such nature that we would run into considerable political or international difficulties.
Is it possible that we could begin along these lines something that we could not finish?
Right. We could start something that becomes a runaway type of change, and we might not be able to eliminate the substances that produce these changes after we've put them into the air. We might get into the same trouble that we've already in with stream pollution and locally with air pollution. But if we pollute on the worldwide scale, we might do things that we cannot really now completely foresee.
And so even in the year 2000, as in 2000 BC and all the years between, there will be international politics and international tensions and presumably agencies busy dealing with them. Which, incidentally, brings up another statistic, that the number of people in government will increase, by the year 2000, up to about one-sixth of the entire workforce. The number of farmers, however, like factory workers, will decline. As for food, in the year 2000, we employed a recent study of more than 500 scientists and research administrators in government and private industry. You would not know the 2000-year supermarket if you came upon it suddenly. It will stock hundreds of new processed items we've never heard of. Packaged diets of all descriptions will be available: fat-free, high-protein, ulcer diets, nerve diets, and so on. Most food for home consumption will cook quickly and be more palatable than today's food. You will probably cook with microwave heat. Breakthroughs in the molecular chemistry of flavor will have been achieved so that all foods may be flavor-intensified. Homemakers will spend less time in the kitchen. Scientists in 2000 will add genes to cereal crops to produce nutritionally balanced proteins. Much of our protein will come from leaves and seeds and from the floor of the ocean. The yields of new hybrid crops will be incredible, and we shall be eating new vegetables as yet undreamed of. There will be little, if any, idle land, but there will be fewer farmers. Most of the farms will be big corporate enterprises. You will purchase square tomatoes. They travel better. Cucumbers for pickling, with each one absolutely identical. You will purchase milk containing whatever percentage of butterfat desired, and other foods with combinations of amino acid content to suit diet and taste. There will still be hungry people in the world. But we will not be earthbound then. We will know about the rocky surface of the moon and many other planets.
Roy Neal interviewed space scientist Kraft Erika of the Aeronautics Division of North American Aviation in Los Angeles. Neal asked him, what are the important factors in using outer space in the year 2000?
One important factor that I would like to mention that is an absolute must so far as space utilization is concerned is low-cost, safe transportation. And I would like also to mention that the utilization of space for our defense is another important factor, which incidentally also touches on transportation. But beyond this, there are other, perhaps even more far-out space utilizations, such as the capability of relaxing in low-G environment, from where we might proceed to an orbital hospital, where we are using the low-G conditions of the environment to rectify certain diseases or correct certain deficiencies on people.
And so in the year 2000, you envision huge floating hospitals circling the Earth, among other things.
Yes, this is definitely a possibility. Hospitals, also hotels, and I might say perhaps even manufacturing facilities.
Do you think, Dr. Erika, that by 2000, men will have moved out to the planets, Mars, Venus, this sort of thing?
Yes, I personally am convinced that this will have taken place, probably more on the basis of exploration yet than of actual utilization. Although by the year 2000, we might conceivably, if we are adopting a sufficiently farsighted attitude toward the development of high specific impulse, that means high energy propulsion systems, we might be able to have already established pretty much a shuttle service between planets Mars and Earth, perhaps Mercury and Earth, and perhaps Venus and Earth, if we once we find out what is on the surface of Venus and really find that there is some form of usefulness, scientifically or otherwise, attached to the surface of Venus. But beyond that, I believe that our research flights, unmanned first and followed in large number of instances manned, may by the year 2000 have gone beyond Mars, Venus, and Mercury, out to Jupiter, the biggest chemical laboratory in our solar system, and to Saturn. I'm sure of that.
Equally important to space is the ocean. In the year 2000, we'll certainly use it for farming. We may even live in the ocean floor. Captain George Bond heads our Navy's Man in the Sea program, and we asked him, just what will the ocean mean to us in the year 2000?
I believe that the ocean will mean your survival by the year 2000. Without the oceans, we will not be capable of getting the protein resources necessary for continued survival on the face of the Earth. Furthermore, we will be deriving large amounts of fresh water from the oceans. We will continue to derive petroleum, mineral deposits, even to obtain the medicines which we will use to treat illness.
What sort of useful work will we be doing on the ocean floor? Mining, oil exploration, or what?
Well, certainly mining will be one big thing. Actual construction work on the ocean bottom will require a man, the hand of man, shall we say. Certainly petroleum search and recovery will be another large feature, and the actual question of farming the ocean waters will require man's attendance, I'm quite sure.
Do you suppose I will vacation at the bottom of the sea?
I think you may well do that. Looking ahead to the year 2000, man should have the capability of living very comfortably down to a depth of at least 3,000 feet and coming and going freely from his house if he wishes to.
What kind of clothes will we wear?
That's a real problem, but by the year 2000 we should have solved it.
So, not all the problems are solved, and the tasks ahead are formidable. If, for instance, we are to have clean air, then we need new factories, and factories powered from a different source. Glenn Seaborg, chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, was asked what kind of power we would be using.
I think that there will be huge energy hearts in which the nuclear source will produce electricity in the range of millions of kilowatts. That is, one huge energy complex will produce electricity in the range of millions of kilowatts, this cheap electricity. And then I think directly associated with and surrounding this energy heart would be a variety of industrial plants, many of which would be interchanging materials and services. They would flow into these plants, scrap from the outside world, and we would be, by that time, reusing our scrap. We would be living essentially in what you might call a junkless civilization. Everything would have to be reused. You would have a sort of an automatic sorting of this scrap as it came into various plants, and then it would join new raw materials that came into the plant and would be routed to the individual specialized plants in the complex for its manufacture into the end product. And I might also say that all this would operate in a relatively clean and quiet manner. Underground arteries and conveyor belts and pipelines would replace mazes of roads and rails, and there wouldn't be any force of chimneys to fill the horizon and pour harmful pollutants into the air, because nuclear power is clean.
We know that automation will take over certain things, and we know that audiovisual aids will help us educate our children. But what about teachers? Will they still be around? We put that question to Francis Keppel, former United States Commissioner of Education and now chairman of General Learning Corporation. This is what he said.
Of course. That's not a question of hope. I think that's a perfectly sensible prediction.
Will every American child in the year 2000 have an opportunity for the amount and the quality of education that he can absorb?
You know, I doubt it. And the reason I doubt it is because, as a guess, in the year 2000, we're still going to be learning, knowing, finding out, what the human mind can absorb. I suspect it can absorb a whale of a lot more than we're teaching them now.
Could it be that in the year 2000, we would be educating on three broad general levels? A for the gifted student, B for the average, and C for the, kind of the dull student.
And the dull student is, by definition, somebody else's child.
Yes, always.
It's for that reason I don't think it'll ever be labeled that way.
Oh, no, it'd have to have a new name.
You'd have to have some other name. You know, there was always a tendency to call some of them rabbits and other ones foxes or something. There's going to have to be, I suspect, human nature being, if my guess is right, somewhat unchangeable, at least over this time period, a flexibility of program between those who learn fast, those who learn less fast, and those who learn slowly. But, let me emphasize the but. People learn different things at different rates. It's not everybody learns everything fast. For example, put me in the face of mathematics and you found the slowest fellow around. In short, it's the flexibility that seems to me point one, so that young people or adults can move from one category to the other, depending on what they're learning. And the second point that I think really has got to be emphasized is what I'd like to call Operation Second Chance. If you're anything like me, you can learn in a whale of a hurry when you really want to. And if you don't, oh my, how dumb you can be. I don't think that's going to change in the year 2000. But 5 years later, you may want to learn in an awful hurry, in which case I think we ought to have Operation Second Chance. That's why I won't quite take the ABC category, unless you say it's true for a particular person in a particular subject at a particular time. In that case, in that sense, yes.
Mm-hmm. Will racial integration in our public schools be completed in 34 years?
My answer is flatly yes. I'm not pretending, and I don't think anybody should kid themselves, that necessarily the deeper social problems will have been wholly solved by then. But the United States should have solved the question of genuine freedom and integration in the public school system. Yes.
I wonder what the broad general aim of our education program will be, Mr. Keppel. Would it be educating for citizenship in a computer-run, leisure-filled, non-work society?
You frightened me enough, so I don't even want to answer the rest of the question by the way you put it. But the, as a guess, the aim of education in any complex society, and surely ours is going to be very complicated with science and social development, can't be put under one general phrase like citizenship or like education for a job or like education for the arts or leisure. It's likely to have a group of aims here. And I would guess that the proportion of the energy given to educating people to have a kind of independence in their own intellectual life, not necessarily related to job, not necessarily related to citizenship, that independence of their own life, that proportion may go up compared to what we now do. We now got a half a dozen purposes as it is. Sure. What we're really talking about is which of these half dozen you put more emphasis on. And I would hope, and I guess it's more a hope than a prediction, that we'd increase the amount devoted to encouraging people to develop their own intellectual interests.
So much for schooling, but how about playtime? Jerry Fry, president of the Toy Manufacturers of America, talked about that. We asked, what kind of toys will kids be playing with in 2000?
In order to answer that question intelligently, I'd almost have to define what a toy is. A toy is nothing in the world more than a plaything, which is a replica of the adult world. If you'd like to tell me what the adult world will be doing in the year 2000, I can probably tell you exactly what toys we'll be making.
What about space and military toys?
Well, I would certainly think that space toys will be on the ascendancy, as will our space operations throughout the universe. As far as military toys go, I must refer to the initial part of my answer. If anybody can figure out how to completely stop wars, undoubtedly, military toys will stop immediately thereafter. If we continue to have them, as we have always had since time immemorial, we'll undoubtedly continue to have war toys.
And little girls, will they still be playing with dolls?
Yes, unless we figure out how to abolish motherhood, which I don't think anybody wants to do. Yes, the doll category in the toy industry has always been the number one category. And from my viewpoint, I would presume it will be in the year 2000 and in the year 3000.
And government, how complex will it get? Will democracy be dead? Vice President Hubert Humphrey started his career as a professor of political science. He has served at many levels of government, municipal and federal. The vice president has done some thinking about government in the future. Mr. Vice President, in the year 2000, will we still govern ourselves democratically?
Yes, I'm sure we will, Chet. At least that would be my judgment. Our democracy, I think, will even be more vital than it is now, primarily because of the developments in communication, the great expansion in the field of education, not only in its quantity, but in its quality. Furthermore, we're reaching down deep now into the American society so that those who have been long deprived of educational opportunity and indeed even citizenship responsibility are going to be given the opportunity for both better education and a chance to perform citizenship duties and responsibilities in their own right.
I would assume then, Mr. Vice President, that creative federalism, in which you have taken such a keen interest in 1966, might be a reality and a working program by 2000.
I think so. I think it must be. And can I say this, that our Constitution is often referred to as the living Constitution. I think that's a very important phrase. It has within it the possibilities of expansion and contraction, of adaptation and of readjustment that is so essential to a growing and a changing national structure, both economic and social. Therefore, when you look ahead to the year 2000, you're going to see governmental institutions that are changed by trial and error, pragmatically, not by theory or doctrine, but by necessity. And we Americans, if we are experts in anything, we're experts in self-government, in representative government. I think that is a real fact of our country. This creative federalism, and I won't hold you much longer on it, is more than just government, though. I've been trying to get people to understand that when we talk about creative federalism, we're not only talking about a partnership, a sharing of responsibilities and duties between federal, state, and local government, but we're also talking about bringing into public service private enterprise, voluntary organizations. You see, the tasks that we'll face in the years ahead are so immense, so unbelievably large and great and complex, that no one governmental structure can meet those tasks. And indeed, the finances, the resources of government are inadequate to those tasks. Therefore, we need to work into a partnership, all levels of government and the private sector, private enterprise, helping to rebuild our cities, to improve our forms and means of communication, to develop our health and educational resources. Rather than having government and private enterprise be competitive, they will, in a sense, be cooperative, but without losing their respective identities.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Vice President, would you guess that in the next 34 years we might see what we might call any amalgamation of government, cities and counties possibly merging, or even states?
Well, I doubt that you'll see states merging. I think that's a pretty firm structure. But you will see states exercising their prerogative and their right of what we call state compacts, where several states may get together on a regional basis to perform certain functions, such as, for example, a transportation or communication function, or a health function, or a police or welfare function. We've seen this already in the New England states, for example, in port authorities, in highway and in transportation functions. Also at the local level of government, I think you'll see what we call councils of local government, where city councilmen, mayors, and even state legislators will become members of a coordinating and planning board known as a council of local government that thinks in broader terms than just the present state lines or the present county or municipal lines. This is inevitable. I'm not at all sure that we need new institutions of government with new taxing authority. What I think we need is to make those institutions we now have pliable, flexible, workable. And, of course, this will at times mean that some cities will become actually city-county government, such as you do have already. For example, in the city of Denver in Los Angeles, you have a county and a city almost as one government, you see.
Yes.
You're going to have more of that as the metropolitan areas grow in intensity and size.
May we assume that we will still have just two major political parties?
Well, you can assume it, and I hope so. But I can only say this, that will greatly depend on whether or not these two political parties meet human needs, meet the requirements of a fast-growing, rapidly changing, highly dynamic social and economic structure.
And you know, finally, Mr. Vice President, there could be some 10-year-old or 12-year-old or 15-year-old listening to this broadcast at this moment, who in the year 2000 will be President of the United States. Who do you suppose he is?
Well, I don't know. I haven't... if it's going to be a lady, I've got a granddaughter that would be just perfectly qualified. But I think maybe it'd be better if I didn't predict. I'll only say this, that if we maintain our senses and if we can save this world from the unbelievable... mistake of world war, the tragic consequences of violence and war. Whoever is president of this nation in the year 2000 will have a great nation with which to work and to to which to give leadership. I haven't any doubt about that. I'm convinced that it'll not be just a society of more things, but rather a society of better people.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Those are some aspects and possible features of the year 2000. Not all of them. For there will be nuances and B-themes in our 2000 society not now dreamed of. But it will be a heterodox society, as it always has been in this country, capable of accommodating many tastes, many desires, and many convictions. There will be a kind of world peace, at least the big war will not have occurred, else this program and all else is in vain. It could be that the United States would not have a single poverty-ridden citizen, and we certainly will be 34 years nearer an achievement which no other nation will have matched, the creation of a multiracial industrial society. Not perfect, still unfinished, still with problems, but functioning very well. The American pretty girl syndrome will be here yet, only more so, and American women will be more beautiful and in greater numbers. The miniskirt, thank heaven, will be about a 30-year-old memory, inducing a voluntary shudder, and 50-year-old men will rub their bald pates, recall their long hair of 1966, and conclude that things have improved.